This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
Hello, you are listening to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Mike Karuchek, and I'm happy and grateful that you've decided to spend a little bit of time chatting with me this morning. Docs for Patient Care Foundation is the sponsor of the Doctor's Lounge. We are a 501c3 organization that promotes patient choice in healthcare. We also talk a lot about the doctor-patient relationship, and we're going to talk about that a lot today as we talk about the events surrounding the untimely loss of beloved comedian Joan Rivers. Today in class this morning, class participation is half your grade. That means I need you to tweet me at D4PCFDN. That's D, the numeral 4, PCFDN, Docs for Patient Care Foundation. I've got my Twitter application open, and I want you to tweet me with questions, comments, and all that kind of stuff. It's required. It's half your grade this morning. So, for the second show in a row, second of my shows, right, I do every other week, and my co-host, Dr. Hal Schirsch, does the weeks that I'm not here. For the second of my shows in a row, I've had to cast aside my grandiose plans for today's show because of events in the news. I was even going to have a show with my first guest, but we had to change all that because of events in the news. And, of course, as I mentioned, the sad event is the untimely and unfortunate loss of comedian Joan Rivers, allegedly as a result of a medical procedure that she had. So clearly, in doctors' lounges all across America, and of course that's what we do here, talk about what doctors are talking about, this is getting a lot of attention. Even my patients are asking me what happened to Joan Rivers because I'm a voice doctor and I see a fair number of famous folks, and I've got my wall with my folks and the signatures just like you see in other places. And I've had probably half a dozen folks ask me, you know, what my opinion was on what happened, and we're going to talk about that today. I've also had patients where I say, okay, I'm going to examine your vocal cords now, and they go, whoa, you're not going to do that Joan Rivers thing on me, are you? And I go, no, this is very different. You're wide awake. Everything's going to be fine. So, in the doctor's lounge, what are doctors talking about as far as Joan Rivers? What would you hear if you were a fly on the wall listening to doctors talk about this? Well, the first thing that you would hear is the same reaction that everyone else has. And the reason for that is that we physicians, and we're going to talk about this a lot today, we physicians are human beings first. And a lot of times we don't get that luxury, but the bottom line is that's the case. We're human beings first. So the first thing you would hear is that we, like everyone else, are mourning the death of a beloved comedian that made us laugh for the past 50 years since her first big break when she was on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. If you haven't seen that, go to YouTube and look at it. It's pretty cool. And so we react. We mourn. We mourn like everyone else because we're human beings first. And after that reaction, of course, we react as doctors based on our training and our experience, and we start to hear the particulars and think about what may have happened. But first, we're human beings, right? Doctors have feelings. We have hopes. We have fears. We have irrational stuff going on just like everybody else. And we depend on positive reinforcement for patients to make us feel good about ourselves. We never get tired of a patient shaking our hand, thanking us for a job well done. But if that patient happens to be a famous patient and it happens to be a celebrity patient who takes your hand in theirs and says, doctor, thank you, I don't know what I would have done if you hadn't helped me. Those feelings when it's a famous patient are a little different. And we have to admit that to ourselves and to each other and to everyone else. Those feelings are a little bit different. Not better. I'm not saying that it's more gratifying to take care of famous people or that we would rather take care of famous people. We love taking care of anybody who comes through the door, but there's no question that it's a little different. It's a little more complex when the patient's famous. And yeah, I mean, you have to admit it's a little bit more self-indulgent. It is. So today we're going to talk about what it's like to be a doctor for famous people, and I have some qualifications for talking about this. I am an ear, nose, and throat physician. That's my training. But following the completion of my residency, I stayed at Vanderbilt for the fellowship in voice disorders, which includes care of the professional voice. And that means I do see a fair number of famous people, and some of those folks are every bit as famous as Joan Rivers. Now, Atlanta's nothing like New York or L.A., but, you know, we do have a number of folks coming through that live here, and because Georgia has become a mecca of sorts, a little mini mecca of movie making because of the favorable state laws and stuff that are here, we have a fair number of folks who come through making movies who need help of one kind or another that an ear, nose, and throat has to give. Sometimes that's a voice problem. Sometimes it's not. But I have a bit of experience to talk about this. So the first thing that hit me when I heard the alleged tales of Joan Rivers undergoing a quote-unquote, you know, procedure on her vocal cords and that something bad happened and unfortunately we've lost her was that this is not the first time this has happened. And like lots of physicians, whether you're a voice doctor or not, first thing you think of is what happened to Michael Jackson in 2010. When his physician was treating him in his home, in his bedroom, supposedly, and was helping him get some sleep and used a general anesthetic, a drug called propofol, which is actually a great drug. It got some bad press as a result of the Michael Jackson thing, but I'm familiar with propofol because I work very closely with anesthesia when we do our cases. We share the airway. We're going to talk about the airway, of course. But propofol is a great drug when it's used correctly. The problem is, here it was not, and there's a lot of similarities between Joan Rivers and Michael Jackson. The unfortunate incidents that you know made us lose those people is that a good technique was being used in the wrong place. And if you know good drugs, good surgical techniques, good surgical decisions, if they're not carried out in an environment that allows them to be done safely, is obviously going to cause a problem. In the case of Michael Jackson, using propofol to try and get some sleep is like using a flamethrower to start your grill in the backyard. I mean, it's a huge, you know, overkill kind of step. And it's easy. It's easy. Whether you're a doctor or not, whether you understand voice problems or airway problems or not, it's easy in situations like this to play Monday morning quarterback and say, well, how? How could these doctors, they're trained, they're supposed to know what they're doing, you know, how could they make such apparently terrible decisions? I mean, what makes somebody crazy enough to push propofol in somebody's bedroom? What makes somebody, daring enough to attempt a procedure on a vocal cord without control of the airway? I intend to demonstrate for you today that it's a whole lot easier than you think. And what I intend to show you today is that when you take care of celebrity patients, you buy into a unique and very dangerous psychology when you take care of celebrity patients. And getting to that point of making a crazy decision is frighteningly easy. It's the ultimate slippery slope. I mean, nobody for that matter, but no physician gets up in the morning and says, I'm going to go to the office and do something incredibly stupid and kill somebody. Nobody does that. We don't wake up and decide in advance that that's going to happen. No one says, I'm going to give a general anesthetic and stop somebody's breathing. Nobody gets up and says, I'm going to go to the office and operate on somebody's vocal cords under unsafe conditions. Nobody goes to the office and says, the next celebrity patient that comes in, I'm going to give them all the narcotics they want so that they love me and tell all their famous friends and thank me on stage, as Joan Rivers has done in the past, found a YouTube with that. Nobody does that. But here's what happens. Things happen when you have a celebrity patient. The doctor-patient relationship is not what it needs to be. Right, we talk about the doctor-patient relationship a lot on this program. The Docs for Patient Care Foundation talks a lot about the doctor-patient relationship. We can describe this problem and the hazards of celebrity patients in terms of the doctor-patient relationship. And in this case, the doctor-patient relationship becomes distorted. It becomes pathologic. And over time, this relationship becomes destructive. It becomes codependent. And when that happens and it goes on for long enough, it's easy for the doctor and the celebrity patient to walk each other down the aisle towards absolute disaster, as I think happened in both of these examples, a recent one with Joan Rivers, a few years ago with Michael Jackson. So to illustrate the point, I'm going to start with a story, and this is a story from my own career and an encounter with a celebrity patient. This is at least 10 years ago, maybe a little longer. It was the weekend of our anniversary, my wife Amy and I, and we were enjoying a wonderful day. The kids were young, and we got them, you know, a friend to care for them, and we got to, you know, have some couple time, and we were up at a beautiful lake in North Georgia. We're walking along the shore of the lake. It's fall. The sun's out. It's a perfect, beautiful, idyllic, romantic moment. And then the phone rings. And it's one of my patients, not a new patient, someone I knew, celebrity patient, was up in New York on Broadway in a show, had a sore throat, terrible pain, high fever, couldn't swallow, getting dehydrated, and the next show's in 24 hours. So the request to me, doctor, please, 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 can you drop what you're doing, get back to Atlanta, pack your bags, get on a plane, I'll fly you up here, first class, private jet, whatever, get you up here, get you in a limo, get you to my room or the show or wherever, and fix me. And the problem is I got 24 hours to do all that. So think about this for a minute. Now, and you don't think of it through a doctor's eyes, but think about it through a plain old human being's eyes. I was being offered a spot on an expense-paid trip straight from my own little world in Atlanta, Georgia, to the glitz and the glamour of Broadway. And I was going to go up there as a VIP, a VIP amongst VIPs. All these people, all these famous people, these beautiful people, these Broadway people are going to see the doctor who was flown in, right? I was going to be the hero, right? I was going to save this star, get them back on stage, and save the show, allow the show to go on. Now, I don't care how mature you are as a doctor. I don't care how professional you are. I don't care how calm and cool and collected you are. There is no way that a request like that that comes through and your phone rings from an A-list celebrity. I'm talking somebody who has been on the cover of People magazine, reported on regularly. This is an absolute A-list person. I don't care how cool you are. There is no way a phone call like that does not blast your ego straight into a low orbit. And you literally get stars in your eyes and gosh, how can I resist this? But, here's the problem. So here we are in the lake in North Georgia. I've got my cell phone in one hand with an A-list celebrity on the line. The other hand, I'm holding my wife's hand and we're walking along the lake and it's our anniversary, for crying out loud. So here is my question to you. And this is your first class question for your class participation grade this morning. I want you to tweet me at D, the numeral 4, PCFDN, at D, the numeral 4, PCFDN, and I want you to tweet me and tell me, what would you do? It's your anniversary. You got your wife right there. It's a beautiful weekend. It's a one in a million time that the kids are taken care of by somebody else, and I got an A-lister on the line that says, I need you to get on a plane and fly to New York and save me and save the show. So we're coming up on a break. Get your smartphone out and tweet me what you would say. We're going to go to break a little bit early here, David. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
Listen to America's Voice for Energy. I'm Marita Noon, and each week I'll guide our discussion on a fresh, news-based energy topic, only on America's Web Radio.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
In 2009, the membership organization Docs for Patient Care was founded. People all around the country wanted to participate in the efforts of this group, and they wanted to join, but they were unable to do so unless they were physicians. It's for this reason that the Docs for Patient Care Foundation was created. Now, everyone can join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. While you're at your computer, please go to www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org, and make a tax-deductible donation and join the fight along with us. Thank you.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
We're back. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I'm your host for this week, Dr. Mike Karuchak, and I'm very grateful that you've decided to spend a little time here this morning. On the weeks that I'm not here, we alternate weeks, Dr. Schurz and I. We try to bring you the things doctors talk about in doctors' lounges all across America. The Doctor's Lounge is sponsored by Docs for Patient Care Foundation, and this is the point in the show where I'm going to make my plea for donations. We at the Docs for Patient Care Foundation donate a huge amount of our time to making this radio show work, to making the other things that our organization does work. We are dedicated to the education not only of physicians but of the general public in issues that are important to your health care. If you like what you hear and you value this sort of thing, please go to www.d4pcfoundation.org. www.d4pcfoundation.org and give generously. We can't keep up these shows. There are expenses. There are things we need to do in addition to just a donation of our time. So please consider supporting what we do if you like what we do. And this morning, please tweet me if you have questions, comments, anything that you'd like to say at the Twitter handle is at D4PCFDN. So please let me hear from you. This morning we're talking about the untimely and unfortunate passing of Joan Rivers and the hazards that come from a doctor-patient relationship when the patient is a celebrity. So at the end of the last segment, I was telling a story about my own career, because as a voice doctor myself, I do see a fair amount of celebrities, and a small number of those are A-listers that are right up there with Joan Rivers and all of the folks that that are in New York doing similar things. And the story was that in the middle of celebrating our anniversary, I get a phone call from an A-lister, a patient who was already a patient of mine, saying, I need you to drop what you're doing, get on a plane, fly to New York, and fix me, because I'm in a Broadway show and I got my next show in 24 hours and I am not well. So the question is, what do you do? You have your wife, you have a beautiful anniversary weekend, and you've got a patient that says you need to drop all that and come and fix me. And the question was, do you do it or don't you? And so what did I do? So David and I were talking about it on the break, and David's suggestion is, look, you got voice doctors in New York. Why don't you just find somebody in New York and get this fixed? And in fact, his answer is what I consider to be the correct answer, and it is what I did. And I said, look, I said, you know, after you indulge this crazy irrational fantasy as a human being rather than a physician, and you indulge this crazy fantasy that you're going to go up there and be a hero and save the day, you know, if you think about what they're asking from a doctor's standpoint, you think, this isn't going to work. This is not going to work. So in 24 hours, right, because it's a Sunday night or whatever, Monday night, they got to be on stage, and I got 24 hours to get myself to Atlanta, get packed, go to the airport, find a flight, get up to New York, find a limousine, find this person, and when I finally get there, it's going to be, you know, 12 hours to curtain, and you can't fix a sore throat, probably strep throat, in 12 hours. That's not going to work. And there's another small problem with this, David. Any guesses? What do you think the problem is with a doctor who's licensed only in Georgia to fly to New York and take care of a patient when I don't have both feet firmly planted on Georgia soil? It's illegal. I don't have a medical license. I cannot go up there and examine a patient, give advice, write a prescription, do whatever. And in the event that this person was dehydrated or needed to be admitted somewhere, right, now I don't have privileges at a place I would need to go. Does this sound familiar? Does this sound like the Joan Rivers issue and a doctor trying to do something where they don't have privileges? If I had gone up there, I would have been in a similar dilemma with a need to take care of somebody acutely and lacking the legal means to do it. And then there was this other small issue, was that it was my anniversary, for crying out loud, and I am not going to leave my wife and go up and do this, not when there's another solution. So I did say no. But I made a counteroffer. I said, look, to this A-lister, this performer, I said, look, there's no way you're going to be able to perform in 24 hours. You're not going to be able to perform in 48 hours, and you're probably not going to be able to perform two or three nights from now. So this is the point where if you're a good voice doctor, you have to understand more than just the medicine. You have to understand the business. You have to understand the entertainment business, and I have some background with that too. So the advice that I gave was more based on the entertainment business and the music industry and the show industry than it was medicine. I said, look, you have an understudy. You have to have an understudy. What's an understudy? An understudy is a person who is prepared to perform a part, but only does so if the person who's actually cast in the role is unable to do it. So if you're, you know, cast as the lead in a show, they have to have somebody who is your understudy in the event that, that you suddenly become ill and you're unable to perform. You know, as they say, the show must go on. And so your understudy is going to step in and do that. It's probably the most thankless job in show business because as an understudy, you have to be totally prepared to do the role at a moment's notice. You probably do almost as much work as the person who's actually cast in the role, but you're probably never going to get to do it. So in this case, I said, look, you got 24 hours. You better call your understudy and tell them they got 24 hours to be curtain ready because you're not going to be there. And I said, look, there's no point in me coming up to New York. If you want me to take care of you, you need to get yourself on a plane and get down to Atlanta because there's no way I can do it up there. And there's no point in me doing it up there. And you're going to be out of commission for a few days anyway. So get yourself down here. Now, if you don't want to do that, I'll find you somebody up there. But if you want me to take care of you, and I'm very flattered, but if you want me to take care of you, you need to get your little self down here. So they took part of my advice. They said, okay, we're not going to perform, but, you know, find us somebody in New York. And so we did that, and they took my advice. And, yes, it took a few days to get better, but everything went fine. So like any medical specialty, I don't care which one you're talking about, you know, chest surgery or endocrinology or whatever, you know, being a doctor in any of those specialties or being a voice doctor like me is easy to do, but it's a lot harder to do well. To be a good voice doctor, you have to understand the entertainment industry, the music industry, as well as the medical piece. So, yeah, you need to know how to treat vocal nodules and acid reflux and all that kind of stuff. But you also have to have some personal experience with movie making, musical theater, non-musical theater, singing in a band, recording in a studio. And, yes, it's part of the reason I'm here, even to learn how to understand talk radio. And over the course of my life and my career, I have been blessed with the opportunity to do all of these things. And I think part of what makes me a better voice doctor than the next guy is that I understand both pieces of the puzzle, the medical piece and the music slash entertainment slash, you know, performing piece. And because of that, just in this situation, a lot of times the scope of advice that I will give vocal performers, you know, it's too broad, obviously, to cover all the way here, but there's just as good a chance that if you're my voice patient, I'm going to give you advice that's related to your performance and how you're going to do what you do musically or on stage as it is to say we're going to take a pill or we're going to operate on something or that sort of thing. So, next, we're going to look at the circumstances surrounding Joan Rivers' death in three parts. The first thing we're going to do is review what information we know. I'm not going to call them facts because we had not had yet a press conference from a fully responsible, fully qualified party that has said this is what has happened, this is what didn't happen. So this is all going to be based on two articles that are in the New York Times. And I'm hoping that coming from the New York Times that this is going to be objective stuff. And I think it's objective for two reasons. One is Paul Krugman didn't write it. And the other one is that they didn't blame George Bush for Joan Rivers' death. So with those two things in our hat, hopefully the New York Times data gives us enough stuff to talk about. And we're going to compare that, again, like we have already a little bit to Michael Jackson, but we're going to take that a little bit farther. The second thing we're going to do is evaluate what happened from a medical standpoint and sort of identify the points of controversy. And then we're going to look into the deeper issues and we're going to drill into this doctor-patient relationship thing that we've already talked about a little bit and explore a little bit more deeply how it is that intelligent, rational caregivers can find themselves in situations where they feel like they have no choice but to do something really stupid and risky. So what I'm going to try to do is use some of this data from the New York Times to sort of create a composite timeline or a story of what may have happened. And I'm going to say ahead of time as a disclaimer that this is all high-level speculation. And I'm going to be as careful as I can to say what has been reported and what I'm doing to kind of fill in the gaps to make a timeline. So, you know, as a starting point, we know that Joan Rivers had a raspy voice. It was part of her trademark, sort of the raspy voice and the New York accent was all sort of part of what we knew and loved her for. And we do know that the night before she had this procedure, she performed at a small venue, and then she had dinner and a drink with a friend, and apparently told that friend, yeah, I'm going in for a little procedure in the morning. She had been complaining of some voice problems and a sore throat and some strained vocal cords. But apparently she did not make a big deal out of it. The following morning, she goes to a place called the Yorkville Endoscopy Clinic. This is a clinic that is what we would call in medicine, we call this a GI lab. more so than a clinic per se. The Yorkville, you know, clinic is a good name for consumers and to be out there to the general public, but this is a facility that is designed only for one thing, which is for GI doctors to do scopes. And you may have heard this called scope from above, scope from below, right? The scope from above is where they put a scope in and look at your esophagus and your stomach and the first part of your intestine. We call that an EGD. And the other one is what's called a scope from below, and that's a colonoscopy. Those procedures are typically done under what we call conscious sedation. You're not fully asleep, but you're certainly not awake. And we're going to talk about the nuances of conscious sedation as well. This clinic opened in 2013, so not long ago. They already had performed 18,000 endoscopic procedures. They had no prior complaints against them. And if you look on the online reviews, the only one I could find was Yelp.com. But Yelp gives Yorkville Endoscopy Clinic 5 stars. They boasted of a transfer rate that was only 1/4 of the national average. What's a transfer rate? That is the frequency by which folks get sick as a result of a procedure that they need to be transferred to a hospital. Their rate was only 1/4 of the national average. So if you take that at face value, that's kind of bragging rights. A spokesperson for the clinic at some point, again reported in the New York Times, said that an anesthesiologist is present for every procedure and that the clinic is fully equipped to fully resuscitate a patient if anything goes wrong. And in theory, that would include respiratory arrest and cardiac arrest like Joan Rivers had. And all that's pretty boilerplate. We have an ambulatory surgery center ourselves. It's not a GI lab, but we do general anesthesia there. We have anesthesiologists present. We have full resuscitation gear present. So that's all pretty much what you would expect a clinic like that to have, in terms of qualifications on paper. One key point here that is reported is that apparently the reason this clinic was chosen was, and apparently it was chosen by Ms. Rivers, and I'm inferring a little bit there, and the wording of the sources of the articles is a bit vague, so I'm being clear here that this is an inference. I don't know this for sure, obviously, but it seems to me, reading between the lines, that this place was chosen by the patient to avoid the publicity of going to the hospital. Because apparently that would generate, you know, lots of paparazzi and TMZ and tabloid press and all that sort of thing. And so understandably, because celebrities get hounded in many ways, their life is not their own, that they would want to do that. So this was done at Yorkville Endoscopy Clinic. And so the morning of that procedure, which was August 28th, a few weeks ago, a patient arrives, a gastroenterologist arrives, her personal physician, whom I think she knew well, and somebody else came, which was an ear, nose, and throat doctor. Now, this is a bit peculiar because an endoscopy clinic, a GI lab, as we doctors would call it, basically only does procedures that are done by gastroenterologists. In my 20-year career as a voice doctor, I have never set foot in a GI lab unless I was a patient. I've never been there as a capacity as a physician, and you really can't because they're not going to privilege non-GI doctors because those aren't the procedures that are done there. They're not equipped to do those sort of things. So it is a bit of an eyebrow raiser that there was an ear, nose, and throat doctor showing up to participate in this procedure. Now, the documentation that comes out, the articles that are written, I identified this ENT doctor as quote-unquote an observer, but they did arrive with a big bag of stuff. We don't know what was in the bag. Apparently, some people thought that she was a makeup artist and was going to fix up Ms. Rivers after the procedure to make her look as good as possible. I'm not sure why you'd want to do that, but fine, be that as it may. But the big thing is this ENT doctor could not have been privileged at a GI clinic because ENT doctors don't do GI procedures. So let's talk about privileges for a minute. How are we doing on time, David? Are we about a minute?
No, we need to break.
We need to break. Okay, so let's break right now. I'm Dr. Mike Karuchak, and you are listening to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. Hi, I'm Dr. Mike Karuchak. Join me and my co-host, Dr. Hal Schurz, as we talk about the topics that doctors talk about amongst themselves, such as Medicare, Obamacare, alternative forms of care, and health information technology. Join us every Thursday morning, 8 to 9 a.m.
Did you miss a show that you really wanted to hear? All of our programs are available for download on AmericasWebRadio.com and on iTunes. You can listen to your favorite programs on AmericasWebRadio.com anytime you like.
In 2009, the membership organization Docs for Patient Care was founded. People all around the country wanted to participate in the efforts of this group, and they wanted to join, but they were unable to do so unless they were physicians. It's for this reason that the Docs for Patient Care Foundation was created. Now, everyone can join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. While you're at your computer, please go to www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org and make a tax-deductible donation and join the fight along with us. Thank you.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.
We're back. You are still listening to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Mike Karuchak. Thank you so much for listening today. We are talking today about the untimely and unfortunate loss of Ms. Joan Rivers, beloved comedian, kept us in stitches for 50 years. Now she's gone, and that's kind of sad. Doctors react to this the same way everybody else does. We mourn first, and then maybe we think about it from a medical standpoint and try to figure out what the issues are that surrounded her loss. So we were talking about a timeline. We were talking about how events transpired starting the night before and going into the day of the procedure. So the morning of this procedure, everyone shows up at a place called the Yorkville Endoscopy Clinic. This was not a hospital. This was a place that doctors would call a GI lab. That's a place where patients who need GI endoscopies, that means either scope from below, above, and look at your esophagus and your stomach and the top of your small intestine, or scope from below to look at your colon. And pretty much everything that is done at a place like this is either one of those two procedures or a slightly more elaborate procedure that is based on one of those two procedures. And that's pretty much the only thing that happens in a GI lab, and probably the only thing that happened at the Yorkville Endoscopy Clinic. And again, I'm inferring there. I don't know that for sure, but my research looking on their website and whatnot would suggest that. So that morning, in addition to the patient coming and the gastroenterologist coming, an ear, nose, and throat doctor shows up with a big bag, and they're identified as an observer. Now, that's okay so far. It's a little bit of an eyebrow raiser to see an ear, nose, and throat doctor show up to treat a patient at an endoscopy lab, a GI lab. But so far, so good, sort of. Now, you've probably heard or read that this doctor was not privileged at this center to perform procedures. So let's dissect that a little bit. To say that this doctor was not privileged is not to suggest that this doctor wasn't qualified to take care of vocal cords. Privileging is something that you must do at every single facility that you work. You know, you might be the best doctor on the planet and you might have privileges at 10 hospitals, but if you go to hospital number 11 and say, I want to work there, they're going to say, no, you need to apply for privileges. So every single facility that you go to, no matter how famous you are, how good you are, or what your on-paper qualifications are, where you went to med school, whatnot, you have to apply for privileges, and they have to review your record. They look at your education, and they look at your malpractice history if you have one, and they request that you send out questionnaires, or they send questionnaires to folks you recommend so that these people can give you a performance evaluation. It's called a peer review or a colleague review, and they will say, yep, you know, I know Dr. Karuchak. I've known him for 10 years. Yeah, he's okay. He's qualified. He doesn't have any problems or issues, and then this gets reviewed by a board, and you are granted privileges. And that has to happen at every single facility that you want to work at. And those privileges are redone every couple of years. They call it recredentialing. And so every 2 years, a board reviews your history and sees what you've been doing and how you've been behaving and what your peers think of you. And, you know, obviously most times they'll renew your privileges, but you do go through a review process. So to say that this ENT doctor wasn't privileged at Yorkville Endoscopy simply says that that person had never been there before. It doesn't say that they weren't qualified from some absolute standpoint to take care of vocal cords. And apparently this ENT physician, and I'm not going to mention the name, you know, it has in the last 24 hours come out in the internet, but I've got nothing in this setting to gain by doing that, so I'm not. But the background on this person is that they're very much like, they do very much like what I do. They see a lot of famous people, and they've got their wall full of, signed pictures, autographed photographs, that sort of thing. All seems very typical for a voice doctor in a big city. So these GI doctors were the ones who actually officially admitted Ms. Rivers to the facility to perform an upper endoscopy or an EGD. And we've already explained what that is. It's a camera on the end of a flexible conduit that you put down the mouth after administering anesthesia called conscious sedation. That means you're sleepy, but you're not really asleep. And we're going to talk about the issues surrounding that shortly. And then what actually happens in that endoscopy room, in that endoscopy suite, is not entirely clear. The two New York Times articles that I looked at said that the ENT doctor, quote-unquote, examined the vocal cords before and after the procedure that the GI doctor did. Now, I don't know exactly what examined means in that setting. I do know, from my own familiarity with how an EGD works, is that this flexible scope that you put down the patient's throat doesn't have an eyepiece on it. It just has a television camera on it, and so you don't look into this scope. All you can do is look at a video monitor. And so it would be very simple, as long as the GI doctor is the one driving the scope, as long as the GI doctor is the one who is manipulating the scope, it is quite straightforward and appropriate, in my opinion, if the ENT doctor was just watching. Right? If they were just looking at the monitor, they're seeing what the GI doctor sees. And yes, in the course of an EGD, you can pause and look at the vocal cords. And yes, you can take a photograph of the vocal cords. But then you got to move on and look at the esophagus. You know, this part of the throat, from an anatomy standpoint, is kind of like a fork in the road. You know, you're looking at the vocal cords with the scope. You're looking behind the vocal cords towards the esophagus. And, you know, in the case of an EGD, you're not going down the vocal cords, right? If you were a lung doctor and you were doing a bronchoscopy, you could drive between the vocal cords and look at the lungs. But in EGD, you're not supposed to do that. You're supposed to go down the esophagus. You take your picture of the vocal cords at most, and you move on. You don't do anything to the vocal cords because you're not in a situation where that's safe. So the question becomes, what do they mean? What do the sources mean when they say that Ms. Rivers had, quote-unquote, a procedure on her throat? And why did the ENT doctor examine the vocal cords both before and after the procedure? Now, there are some allegations, and again, this is unsubstantiated, and I certainly have no way to look into this beyond doing the same web search that you would do, that apparently a biopsy was, I don't know if you would call it performed or started or something, but the implication is that at some point perhaps this ear, nose, and throat physician took over the procedure, which I would interpret as the ENT doctor took the controls of the scope, the driving controls. This scope has a thumb wheel on it for steering up and down and left and right, and so you drive this thing with two hands. You put your right hand on the thumb wheel, and your left hand goes over the patient's nose and mouth to position the scope, and that's how you do this. So as long as the ENT doctor doesn't lay their hands on the scope and all they're doing is watching the video monitor, then, in my opinion, everything's fine if all they're doing is watching. But the question that is raised, not necessarily answered, but the question that is raised is, what happened? Did the ENT doctor take controls of the scope or take control of a biopsy forceps and start doing something to the vocal cords? Which, you know, in my opinion, you know, if you're doing an upper endoscopy in a GI lab, that's verboten. You're not supposed to do that. So regardless of what happened, regardless of whether the ear, nose, and throat doctor either just observed or actually took over and started driving the scope or driving a biopsy forceps and started doing something, near the end of the procedure, things began to come unraveled. And her oxygen level, Ms. Rivers' oxygen level, started dropping fast. That would have been something they monitored on a second-to-second basis. Nobody knows why. There's been some theories put forth. One was that something called a laryngospasm occurs. That's where the larynx responds to an irritation or something being introduced into it by snapping shut like a sphincter. The vocal cords snap shut. They stay closed. The muscles stay, you know, contracted tight as a drum. You're not going to move them. You're also not going to move any air in and out of the patient as long as the laryngospasm is taking place. So that was one theory. The other theory that was put out there, again, not reputable sources, not any kind of official account. This is the highest level of conjecture. But that there was some swelling as a result of whatever was done to the vocal cords. And if the vocal cords swell, then yes, there is potential that you lose the airway that way. And then other theories out there have been that, well, she had a pre-existing heart condition or some other pre-existing condition that the stress of all this caused something else to happen, you know, heart attack, stroke, blood clot, you know, you run through the list. But in any case, their attempts to fix the rapidly crashing oxygen levels did not work out, and 911 was called at 9:40 a.m., 20 minutes to 10. And apparently the EMT response, the emergency medical system response was flawless. Within 4 minutes, less than 6 minutes, the first responders arrived. Within another 4 minutes or 10 minutes total, there were 10 emergency responders coming on the scene from at least three separate places. At some point, a breathing tube was put in. And it's not clear to me looking at stuff whether that breathing tube was put in by the folks who worked at the clinic or whether that breathing tube was put in by the emergency responders. It doesn't matter. What seems clear is that there was a low oxygen-driven injury to the brain, and although they saved her heart, they didn't save the brain. That's, again, high level of conjecture. She was on life support for a few days, and then the life support was withdrawn. Folks close to the situation have said, and I'm quoting from the source, "We would love to set the record straight, but our lips are sealed." So we're not going to know for a while exactly what happened. You know, the timeline I gave you is based on two articles published in the New York Times plus some conjecture on my part. Again, I know nothing else in terms of primary information besides what I got from the internet, same thing you can get. So let's be clear on that. But this does raise some questions. Right? The first question I have is, what exactly was wrong with her in the first place? We know that she has a raspy voice at baseline, so there must have been something new going on, and that's common. I see patients like that all the time, and they're are well-known examples that we can talk about, right? We all know that Louis Armstrong's voice was raspy, but that was part of his trademark. We know that Rod Stewart's voice is really, really raspy. We know that's part of his trademark. Kim Carnes is another one from decades gone by with a raspy voice. Again, that's part of what we recognize. That's a part of their trademark. So what was new? What happened that prompted her to need a procedure or at least to want to have a procedure? What was the reason they were there? There's all sorts of other questions that have been raised. Was she medically screened before the procedure? Was there some underlying heart problem, lung problem, something like that that may have caused things to come unraveled just as a result of being sedated? What were the sedatives given? You know, there was one source that said she got propofol. You know, the Michael Jackson drug, and propofol's got a bad rap. Well, guess what? Propofol's a great drug if you use it in the right place and you have the right qualified people giving it. You know, I would gladly have propofol given to me if I knew all the people around me were qualified to do it and the setting was appropriate. You know, are outpatient centers a safe place to give care? That's another thing that's been brought up. We may get to that at the end. We may not. My opinion is, yes, they are an absolutely safe place to give care if you do everything correctly and you live by the rules that have been set down in advance. What was the deal with her conscious sedation? You know, do you do vocal cord procedures under conscious sedation? We're going to talk about that, too. And then we're going to talk about the $64,000 question. And this is what we may spend most of the rest of the time on when we get to segment four in a couple of minutes, is was the fact that Ms. Rivers was a celebrity, did this affect the medical decision-making process in a way that led to a bad outcome? We are coming up on the end of segment three. You are listening to The Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. Come back. That's an order.
In 2009, the membership organization Docs for Patient Care was founded. People all around the country wanted to participate in the efforts of this group, and they wanted to join, but they were unable to do so unless they were physicians. It's for this reason that the Docs for Patient Care Foundation was created. Now, everyone can join the fight and become a member of an organization created by doctors for patients, dedicated to fighting for your healthcare freedom and preserving the doctor-patient relationship. While you're at your computer, please go to www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org. That's www.docs4patientcarefoundation.org and make a tax-deductible donation and join the fight along with us. Thank you.
Don't be hoodwinked by the left, who wants you to believe the fairy tale that we can power America on butterflies, rainbows, and pixie dust. I'm Marita Noon. Get the truth about energy on my show, America's Voice for Energy, only on America's Web Radio.
Hello, I'm Dr. Mike Karuchak. Have you ever wondered what doctors talk about amongst themselves? If you do, join us on the Doctor's Lounge and hear the doctors' conversations amongst themselves. Join me and my co-host, Dr. Hal Schertz, every Thursday morning, 8 to 9 a.m.
This is AmericasWebRadio.com, the best in chat radio designed just for you.
We're back for segment 4 of the Doctor's Lounge. You are listening to the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Mike Karuchak. Thanks for sticking around all the way to segment 4. I promise we'll make it worth your while. We are going to wrap up this discussion of the circumstances surrounding Joan Rivers' untimely, unfortunate, sad loss. We were just talking about the timeline that occurred during the day that she had this ill-fated endoscopic procedure, and we were reviewing, I don't even want to call them facts, call them data points. I don't know what to call them because I want to be very careful that this is not some sort of faux expert witness testimony or something like that. There is, you know, we have no medical records. We have nothing except what all of you have. If you go and Google Joan Rivers and read what comes up, that's all we've got. And that's all that you've got. So we're just, all I'm trying to do is sort of layer my experience as a vocal cord specialist onto that and maybe try and fill in some of the blanks. But be clear, these are inferences. This is high level speculation and nothing more. So we'll start back at the beginning. So Joan Rivers was always known for this raspy voice. We talked about that. We talked about the fact that there are lots of other people like Rod Stewart and Louis Armstrong and Kim Carnes that have this gravelly kind of voice. You know, lots of comedians. I think probably George Carlin had a raspy voice too. But lots of folks who have a characteristic voice which would be characterized medically as abnormal, and yet it's a part of what they do. So for Ms. Rivers to want something done to fix something, there must have been a change. There must have been some sort of new onset problem that prompted her to have a procedure. And so this leads me to consider one of two possibilities. Either she had a problem that, and there was a GI-related diagnosis suspected, like, let's say, acid reflux or something. And so there was a decision made that apart from the ENT issue, there was a GI issue that required a GI procedure, that required an upper endoscopy, an EGD, we call it, an examination by scope of the esophagus and the stomach and the upper part of the intestine, separate from the vocal cord issue. That's one possibility. The other possibility is that the EGD was just a vehicle to get her to a procedure room so that the vocal cords could be looked at, and therefore the vocal cord problem was the primary issue, and that really the only reason there was a GI doctor was for window dressing. The meat and potatoes of this was to get the vocal cords looked at. So if we assume that and we look at this through the, you know, the hindsight vision of 2020 or Monday morning quarterback, call it what you will, both of these scenarios create an issue. I have been in similar situations before, have been challenged with similar problems before, where a GI doctor is doing an EGD. They identify an abnormality on the vocal cords. That's one possibility. Another possibility is in the operating room, and now we're talking a formal operating room, that an anesthesiologist, while they're putting a breathing tube in somebody for a different operation, right now we're talking full-blown surgery with a full general anesthesia, they're putting a breathing tube in, which Joan Rivers did not have, and until bad things happen, and they identify a problem on the vocal cords. But almost always, in a situation where a vocal cord abnormality is identified as what we call in the business an incidental finding, right? An unexpected, whoops, what do we have here? No clue it was there till you actually did the procedure. Usually what happens in those situations is that somebody takes a picture of it, somebody documents it, and then we get a phone call later on. Or if we get a phone call right on the spot, we say, look, finish what you're doing, send the patient to me in the office, and I'll have a look at what's going on. Now, there is one noteworthy exception to that, and that is if the anesthesiologist in the operating room placing the breathing tube sees something so abnormal that the airway is immediately threatened. And they say, yeah, we got the breathing tube in, but we're afraid to take it out. Now, in that context, I will drop what I'm doing. And this has only happened maybe a half dozen times in 20 years. I'll drop what I'm doing. I'll go to the operating room before they finish their procedure and have a look at the airway with a breathing tube already in place and try to figure out what's going on. You know, in rare cases, you might have to do a tracheotomy, which is where you make an opening in the neck so that you can get the breathing tube safely out of the mouth and have a look at what's going on. But even in those rare, extreme situations, I am going to a facility where I am already privileged, which is different than the Joan Rivers situation. And we're looking at the airway in a situation where there is a general anesthetic in place and a breathing tube in place. Well, let me make one other point before I move on. You know, the irony here is that the place that I can get the best examination of your vocal cords is not a GI lab. In some ways, it's not even the operating room. It's in my office, because any voice doctor is going to have imaging equipment, specifically something called a video stroboscope, which is going to give you the best possible visual inspection of somebody's vocal cords. So I'm a little puzzled why, if the objective was to get a look at Ms. Rivers' vocal cords, why you would do that in an EGD suite when, you know, as a wide awake patient walking around, I can take you to my voice lab, and I think this doctor in New York had a voice lab too, with the same equipment I've got. I can take you to my voice lab and I can get a better picture of your vocal cords than I can get in an EGD suite or an upper endoscopy suite. So if the objective was just to look, if the objective was just to observe, I'm not sure why you would choose that method to do it. And again, I'm not suggesting anything regarding standard of care. I'm staying away from all of that for obvious reasons. These are just sort of, you know, head-scratching questions and nothing more. So let's talk about, we've just got a few minutes left. We also need to dissect out this anesthesia issue. I've made numerous references to this idea of conscious sedation. And this is typically what is done when you're doing an upper endoscopy. There's three levels of anesthesia. We'll back up a little bit. There's three levels of anesthesia when you are doing something to somebody, and I don't care whether you're doing something in the ear, nose, and throat, or the voice of the throat, or it's on their big toe. You've got three options for how you handle making the patient able to tolerate what you're about to do. One is called local anesthesia, and that means you don't give anything by mouth, you don't give anything in the vein, there is no systemic drugs given, there's no sedation given, you just put a little lidocaine where the problem is and numb it up and then put the stitches in, right? You show up at the ER with a cut on your arm, they're going to do it with local anesthesia. They're going to numb it up, they're going to let it get numb, they're going to put some stitches in it. When you go into the ER wide awake, you walk out wide awake, there are no systemic medicines given. That's option number one. That's one extreme. You're wide awake the whole time. The other extreme is a general anesthetic. That means you go fully to sleep. Right? You're not sedated but awake. You go fully to sleep. When you go fully to sleep, your brain's drive to spontaneously breathe is completely turned off by the anesthetic. And therefore, you have to have a breathing tube put in, or at least a mask used, but 99% of the time, a breathing tube put in that is so that a machine can breathe for you. So that's the other extreme. Then you have the middle ground. And the middle ground has always been a place that's a little bit scary to me. I have never done a procedure under conscious sedation in many, many years. But this is that middle ground. And the middle ground is where you get some medicine in a vein and you are made sleepy, but your spontaneous drive to breathe, your body's automatic mechanism that keeps your diaphragm moving and keeps the air moving is supposed to remain intact, right? We call that spontaneous respiratory drive. That's supposed to remain intact, but you don't have a breathing tube in. Now, experience, I think, has shown that that is a safe way to do a lot of things, upper endoscopy being one of them, unless you start fiddling with the vocal cords, as allegedly happened in this case. And once you start fiddling with the vocal cords, you cross a very, very big line, because now you are messing with the airway, and you are messing with the airway without control of the airway. You're doing it with no breathing tube in place, and I think that's the fatal line that was crossed. So that leaves the last question. And we talked about it at the beginning of the hour, so we'll talk about it here at the end. It's that ultimate Monday morning quarterbacking 2020 hindsight question, which is how? How is it that doctors that are experienced, doctors that are trained, doctors that have done this a zillion times before and done it the right way with presumably plenty of experience, how is it that they paint themselves into a corner and apparently make decisions which after the fact look absolutely insane? Right? Why would you operate on a vocal cord without control of the airway? In the case of Michael Jackson, why would you give a general anesthetic medicine, a medicine that has the potential to completely turn off your spontaneous respiratory drive, like we talked about, so you're not breathing on your own anymore? Why would you do that in somebody's bedroom? It seems so obvious after the fact. But my message to you, and again, if this is the classroom, this is where the professor says, if you only remember one thing from today's lecture, this is it, is that when the doctor-patient relationship involves a celebrity patient, the relationship becomes distorted. It becomes pathologic. I would even go so far as to describe it as a co-dependent relationship in which the power structure is turned completely upside down. For example, about a month ago, I had a patient come in to my office, not a celebrity, regular old person like you and me, and they wanted their thyroid gland out. And I thought, well, you know, 99% of the time, if somebody wants their thyroid gland out, if they want surgery, well, there's usually a darn good reason that they want it. They've been referred by somebody who's worked them up, and, you know, maybe their thyroid function is out of whack, or maybe they've got a nodule that looks like cancer, or usually there's some reason to do it. Well, this particular patient didn't seem to have any of those reasons when we looked over all of her records and all that stuff. And I said, well, excuse me, I'm a little confused as to, you know, why it is you want your gland out. And she was like the patient was very adamant, you know, I want this gland out. I'm worried about it. And, you know, talking to this patient over a few minutes, you figure out that, you know, she had some sort of family event or something, had a relative with thyroid cancer or had a bad experience or something. And so it was one of these situations where she just wanted to not wait till the last minute. Right, and just get her thyroid out before something happens. But in that situation, it was easy to say no. I said, well, no, I don't think we need to subject you to the risk. And once I walked this patient through, hey, look, this is surgery. You've got risks. You could lose your voice. You could lose your airway. I mean, you know, there's a one in a million chance that very bad things happen. And if there's no reason, why would you want to be subjected to the risk? But it was easy to say no. When the patient's a celebrity, it is so much harder to say no. The power structure is completely turned upside down. And now you have a celebrity patient, and the doc is vulnerable, right? We're human beings, right? And, you know, depending on who the celebrity is, we react very much the same way everybody else does when they see an A-lister in person. You get excited, and this person's coming to you. It's a huge ego boost. So if a celebrity patient comes to you asking for something that's not medically appropriate, it is very hard to say no. Because if you say yes, you become a doctor to the stars. These people are going to thank you. They're going to refer all their famous friends, and, you know, you get stars in your eyes. If you say no, you're a troll. You're no good, and you know, they're going to go find somebody that does what they want to get done. So, you know, we're humans, we're vulnerable. And that is the message for today. Thank you for listening. This is the Doctor's Lounge on America's Web Radio.
You're listening to AmericasWebRadio.com, the pioneer and leader in chat radio. Thank you for listening.